my hobby became income streams. How do I get more and how can I invest in them? And I started by investing in funds and things that had cash flow. And then once I understood sort of the fund landscape, for instance, if I want to invest in mobile home parks, I might invest in mobile home park fund first. And then I learn, okay, what's important? How do these guys do it? And then I would go out and get an individual deal. And then I might eventually buy a park myself.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Says, Cody is a reform journalist turned investor who over the course of her career has bought and sold over 66 businesses, built two seven-figure businesses, and now runs a portfolio of 26 companies ranging from car washes to laundromats to paid newsletters and everything in between. Cody, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Stoked to be here.
Super excited to have you on. I want to start off with a question that I read on your website that I think will really tee up the rest of this conversation pretty nicely with, what does it mean to think like an ocean?
So I talk about this when it comes to income streams. So basically, back in the day when I was working, you know, for some of the big Wall Street firms, I might've made a lot of money, but I really had it from one source. And so I call those rivers. Your income sources are a river that eventually gets into the ocean, which is the pool of your net worth. And so most people have like one river that goes to the ocean. I like to try instead to have a bunch of rivers, have a bunch of tributaries, have a bunch of rivulets that basically funnel down into this eventual large pool of assets. And so most people, I think, you know, if something happens to your river, if it dries up, if it gets blocked, if it gets dammed, then you're kind of screwed. And our whole philosophy is, how do you branch those out into lots of tributaries instead of just one source?
When did you have the mindset shift between working a, you know, investment job, high level Wall Street to, hey, let's start a bunch of small businesses and get a lot of these different rivers contributing to my ocean?
I think like most people, I thought about it for a long, long time before I ever did anything, right? You know, I was listening to podcasts like this. I was reading books on, you know, like Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Buy, Not Build and, you know, Lifestyle Investor and all these different books and thinking like one day I'm going to do it. And during that time, I was just working on making more and more money. And I didn't really have any idea how to do anything besides climb the corporate ladder. Like the idea of buying storage units, like we were talking about, or investing in mobile home parks was just so foreign to me. I knew how to take my money and I knew how to put it into my, you know, at the time, I think it was like a Vanguard account or something, right? Like that is what I knew how to do. And like, fingers crossed, market increases and, you know, my money grows. And then at some point I started getting a little burned out. I was doing like 60, 70 hour weeks, traveling nonstop. I was going down to Latin America a lot where I ran a big asset management business. And I started getting into it with the CEO and we just disagreed on how to run business going forward. And I was like, what am I going to do if I have this lifestyle still and I don't have this income stream anymore? And so I just made that my hobby. My hobby became income streams. How do I get more and how can I invest in them? And I started by investing in funds and things that had cash flow. And then once I understood sort of the fund landscape, for instance, if I want to invest in mobile home parks, I might invest in mobile home park fund first. And then I learn, okay, what's important? How do these guys do it? And then I would go out and get an individual deal. And then I might eventually buy a park myself. And so that was my process. And I just replicated that across multiple asset classes.
And what were some of the first asset classes that you actually went from investor from a fund standpoint to like, hey, I actually just found my first mobile home park or laundromat or whatever it is. And like, here's $100,000. Here's the operator. Go to get to work kind of thing.
So I started off in broad-based private equity. So private equity funds, broadly based. I was investing across the spectrum. And then I actually think the very first one that I did was probably in Latin America. I invested in a Latin American venture fund. Then I said, wait a second, I could be value add. So I want part of the venture fund. Like, can I get some carry and part of the GP for investing alongside you? And then I said, hey, if I sourced you guys deals, can I take a percentage of like the deals that I give you? So I sourced them a deal that ended up being a great deal for us, like a 30X or something like that. It's called Kushki. It's still around.
Not
bad at all. It was like a mixture of luck and naivete, I guess. And then I started investing in those companies directly. And then I owned a distribution business in Latin America. So that was basically like distributing investment products. And I basically bought that business and grew that business ourselves. And then for like a more reasonable US example, I think laundromats are a good example. I invested in a private equity fund, then I invested in a laundromat sort of a deal syndicate of a few of them. Then I invested in an individual company and ran it from there.
Which income streams do you think are most exciting right now? Or where are you spending most of your time, I guess, researching? Is it the laundromat and kind of car wash side? Or do you have anything else that's up your sleeve?
Well, so I'm at a little bit different of a point now. So now I'm at a point where I don't want to run anything. I want complete passivity, and I want my income to also be accelerated from this large media business that we've built and the fact that I can bring more assets to the table. So now I would say I'm at like more of like a 3.0 or a 4.0 level where it's like, I don't want to buy the company and run it outright. I don't want to buy the company and put an operator and have to watch the operator anymore. What I want to do now is be the capital for the guy who wants to buy the company and put the operator and watch it. And so you'll see like, you know, I used to have 33 businesses that I was actively invested in. Now I've divested down to about 26 different businesses that I've invested in, because I think that this audience that we have can be a lever for capital. And so what we're going to do going forward is more large minority stakes in these type of businesses with operators and people in place. I'm not going to run them day to day. And then probably we're going to launch a venture capital fund that supports the infrastructure of boring businesses. So like, for instance, now that I've invested, I don't know, everything from vending machines to car washes to laundromats to landscaping to et cetera, I sort of see these 10x opportunities. Like in vending machines, you have to have, I like to put automated card readers on them. And so same thing for laundromats. You want to change from the coin only to the automated. It just makes all your processes easier. And that company is called Nyax. So, you know, I want like a secondary securities portion of Nyax. And so I think what you see when you think about investing from my standpoint is it's a lot like real estate. You start with like live in your parents' basement, and then you go and rent a place with a friend, and then you rent a place by yourself, and then you buy the first studio, and then you buy the two family, you know, condo, and then you buy the house, then the multifamily, then the storage, then blah, 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 right? And so that's the same thing with investing in small businesses. You start out small, and then you kind of keep up leveling to increase your leverage in time and money.
That's really well said. I want to take it back to something that you kind of hinted at earlier, and I'm not sure if this is like a fully fleshed out idea or just what you were using in the example where you said at this point now you're like a level 3 or level 4 in terms of investors. So like you don't want to go and, you know, handle the operations of anything. You just want to go and finance it and provide the capital. I think a lot of our audience is in their 20s, and we are bombarded on a daily basis, whether it's YouTube ads of gurus on the beaches in Tulum talking about how they're making passive income and not doing any work, or even like more reputable sources like BiggerPockets is really great for learning how to get into real estate, but they also preach this passive income dream all the time, when in reality, like it might be 2 a.m, you might get a phone call after like fix the toilet, right? And I think not a lot of people see that when they're first starting off. They just think of like, oh, I'm just gonna spin this thing up and, you know, bada boom, bada bing, like I'm gonna go and start making money like every single month. Are there levels to this that you kind of think about, or I'd love to kind of like know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I should flesh it out and have like real definitions for each of them. I don't at this point, but I think you nailed it. Well, I kind of talk about three legs of a tripod. So for wealth building and investing in businesses, there's sort of three legs. You can have money as one leg of leverage. You can have time, you know, ability to spend time on something, or you can have expertise. And depending on those three legs of the stool is where you're going to decide which one to sort of lean on or stand. Most people, it starts out as you have more time because you're younger, and you probably have less money and you have less expertise. And so the three legs, how they kind of level up in my mind is it starts with like time is the lowest lever point. That's where you're going to start. You're going to spend more time finding deals, doing work, doing whatever until you get to the expertise stage. And then instead of just trading your time for money, you can trade your expertise for money too. So like you guys, you have some expertise in storage already. So you don't have to go and do all the stuff like you did in the beginning. You might be able to leverage that expertise into getting somebody else's money. And then finally, you get to the stage where you have more money than you have or want to use expertise or time. And so when you get to the big dollar standpoint, that's why you see all the VCs. Why do VCs do what they do? Why do private equity funds do what they do? Because they've scaled up from the time to expertise to this ultimate form of capital where the money works for you instead of you working for the money. But to your point, you got to start somewhere. And, you know, every time I've bought a business, I'm involved in the beginning of the business. I mean, if for nothing else, then even finding the deal, vetting the deal, closing the deal, getting the money for the deal. It's work. And then as soon as I close the deal, maybe I could hand it all off, but I'm still looking at the P&L on like a weekly or monthly basis, if nothing else. So I think you're exactly right. Maybe you could get passive income if you're really good at trading stocks, like the gurus talk about, and you can click a few buttons and get some endorphins and the market goes up forever. But I don't think there's anything ever that's a totally free lunch.
For someone that's our age, and as you mentioned, probably has that one leg of time on their hands. They don't have money. They don't have expertise. They don't really have connections. What do you kind of recommend they do to get from that zero to maybe 100K a year in kind of cash flow so that they can get rid of that first, you know, leg and start looking upstream a little bit more?
So we wrote a blog post on this actually last week. If you go to contrarianthinking.co and talk and look at the Wealth Tripod, we explain it. But let me give you the 30-second version because I tend to be lengthy in those blog posts. So there'll be more steps there. But essentially, what you do is when you're first starting out with that time component, all you want to do is you want to steal the other people's two legs, right? So you're almost thinking about it like, I have time. I need to find somebody else who has expertise in this asset class, use it. And I need to find somebody who has money and is willing to do something with me in this asset class. So I think the easiest example, although there are 500 examples, would be, say you've never invested in a storage unit before, but you're like, man, I work in an ad agency. I like it. I want to keep doing what I'm doing, but I want another income stream. So I want to invest in a storage unit, but I have 20 bucks. So it's probably not going to do it. Then what you're going to go do is you're going to go find somebody who's invested in storage before or who knows about storage. And you're going to say, I'm going to do all the work, find the deal, try to put it together for us, you know, find us investors. Would you be willing to lend me your expertise in the deal? And I'll give you a cut of it or we'll work together on it. And then, you know, we can own this thing together. Or you go to somebody who has expertise and capital and say the same thing. Hey, Nick Huber, I know you're always looking for, you know, deals in storage. What if I bring you a deal and you buy that deal? Can I get a cut of that deal? And I just want to watch and learn through the process about how you actually capitalize on it while getting some percentage of the carry or upside. Those would be the two ways that you do it without capital. You basically trade your time for those other two legs of the stool.
That's awesome. I think when I hear people with portfolios similar to your own, two things happen. One, I get very jealous because I'm like, I want that same exact thing. Like, I'm like over time, give me enough years and I'm going to start building up like my own portfolio as well. The other thing that happens is I get very, I don't know if overwhelmed is the right word, but like confused from the standpoint of like, you have 26 companies and you have more companies than hours in the day, right? So what I would love to know is how do you go and track and manage all of that? Is it just finding outrageously good operators and like just track it through the bank accounts? Like, I have no idea where to even begin with that.
Yeah, I think, what we still get a little funky, I think, is like, imagine that I tell you that I have a business and we have 26 products that we sell. Imagine that I have a business and I tell you that I have 26 employees. Imagine I have a business that I tell you about that does $26 million. Like, we think about these independent businesses like they're something that we have to operate and run all the time, but you wouldn't feel that way if I had 26 employees or if I had 26 products or SKUs, or if I had a business that had 26 different things that brought in income, like ads and content and educational sources and whatever. Those would be like 26 revenue streams inside of a business, right? And so it's just new, I think, for people to think about holdcos, these holding companies, as income streams or a way to capture everything. So that would be the first thing is like, I think when you're intimidated about something, first, it's good to talk to people like me because you realize, she's not that smart that she could do that. Like, I could totally do that. So like whatever she's doing, I just need to learn more about it because the reason that I'm scared of it is there's an information gap that I don't have yet. She's achieving this. She's not a fucking rocket scientist. It freaks me out. Ipso facto, I need to close the information gap between the two of us. And if I can close the information gap between the two of us, then I could probably do something similar or even smarter, you know? And so that would be the first thing. Second thing is it's all about incentive alignment. Everything in life, like even having 26 employees is a nightmare. And I don't do that. I don't ever have 26 direct reports. But the way that you do it, it makes sure that the people that you hire or the businesses that you invest in have incentive alignment. And to your point, we do something called decentralized leadership. Warren Buffett famously is the one who sort of came up with this in tandem with his mentor. It's basically summarized in one line. When you get a dog, don't do the barking for them. And so when you hire an operator, don't operate the business. You have an operator that's going to operate the business. All you have to do is make sure that you have transparency into expenses and revenue and you understand the 3 to 5 KPIs for each business that actually drive it every single week, month, and year. And even at some point you back out from that too. And you say, I've already recouped my investment on it. I'm going to treat this like a bond. I don't watch my bonds every week to see what they're doing because I know that the operator is aligned and invested in the business correctly. So if you start with decentralized leadership and making sure incentives are aligned, a lot of the headache goes away. Don't get me wrong. There's headache. So I don't want to fake you out on that.
Having had the opportunity to look at probably thousands of companies, I'm assuming at this point, and looking at the relationship between operators, investors, et cetera, is there anything that kind of stands out from a personality or skill set that, you know, you could say, hey, this person's going to be, you know, successful down the road? And is there really any way to also cultivate that in the beginning?
I think there's a couple different things. The first one is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So winners win. And, you know, people could say, no, we need another chance or whatever. And that's true. That certainly happens sometimes. But the higher the likelihood of somebody to succeed really depends on how they've done it in the past. And that could, you guys could be, you know, winners without ever owning a business because you were, you know, president of the school and you did multiple sports and, you know, you had good grades while you also did the side hustle. Basically, you're looking for a trend line of outperformance and consistency and competitive winning. And so that's the first thing that I want in operators. I don't want somebody who every time I talk to them is like, well, this didn't work out because of that. And that one is because John was a real, you know what, like, nope, that's good luck with somebody else's money. Second thing I would say is when you're going to have lots of operators, you really want to make sure that the energy is aligned, which is like as woo-woo Austin as I'll get on you today. But imagine that I get on a call and I have one operator that's currently like this, and it's probably not going to work out. Hope he doesn't listen to this, but he won't maybe know. But basically every time I get on the call, he's like, hey, you know, what's going on? Hey, how are you? Yeah, you know, the ex-wife, I'm like, what's happening over here in the house, you know, and I'm just like, oh my God, like not my circus, not my monkeys. Like, I don't have time to be talking to you about this other stuff. Like the energy has to be there and it has to be the kind of person that's going to get after it. And so don't dismiss that feeling you get when you meet with somebody and you're like, oh, this person is a winner. They've won in the past and they're on it. They're just like coming up with interesting ideas, always talking about executing continually. And then the third thing is known versus unknown experience. You know, I have two friends, Sieva and Xavier, and they run something called Enduring Ventures. And we all sort of agree on this idea that the best way to find an operator for an HVAC company or a plumbing company is to hire a former operator of an HVAC company or a plumbing company. And so some of this stuff is not rocket science. It's just like, oh, the guy's a winner. He has great energy and he did this before. I bet he could do it again. And then once he's done it before with you, you know, he has this HVAC thing, then you can say, okay, next company you want to run is something totally different. Hey, no problem. I've already seen you win in this. Then we can diversify. But I really like to make sure that they already know the asset class. I would rather steal than teach for the most part.
That's awesome. I feel like people are going to listen to this right now. This is kind of what I was talking about in the beginning of the call too, where a lot of podcasts, especially when it comes to operators and like running multiple businesses, my guess is somebody who's 22, 23 is going to listen to this right now and be like, that's cool and all. And like Warren Buffett's great. And these philosophies are great, but like I have $30,000 in the bank right now and I'm not able to go and execute the same way. And I think maybe this brings us back to kind of like that three-legged stool wealth creation that you kind of talked about, but like, what are some of the more, let's say that they did want to go and get involved. They wanted to go and buy, you know, an RV park or do something in the HVAC space or something like that. What are some of the more creative ways that you've seen people go and buy either businesses or real estate without necessarily having a really big checkbook?
Yeah. Well, one, I think it's a total fallacy that you need a lot of cash. I mean, I literally was talking to a partner at Sequoia, the venture capital firm, one of the largest in the world. And he told me that to them, they literally aren't accepting more money. They're like, capital is a commodity. I don't need any more money. So there's so much money sloshing around right now that what people actually need are executors or operators. And so if you're a young gun and you want to own a mobile home or an RV park, the only thing that I see young people do wrong, quote unquote, in my opinion, is they want what you said. They want, I want it to be passive and I have no money. And it's like, well, it's too fucking bad. I don't know what the answer is for you. Like, go invest in the real estate or, you know, stock market or something and do it in a fractionalized manner. And you're just going to grow more slowly. And that's fine. Like, you can't typically have both. No money and no time, typically not going to work out. But what I would say is, if you have time, and really everybody says they don't have time, everybody's busy, you just don't have the luxury of not having time when you're young and hungry. Like, you just got to make the time is sort of the moral of that story. And there's plenty of other people that can teach you how to do that. So I'll leave that off. But what I would say is, like, go out and get investors. Like, I love when I get, dude, I can't tell you how seldom I get pitched young people saying, hey, I want to go do X and Y and Z and buy this. I found this deal. Here's the terms. Here's the specifics of it. It's going to cash flow like this. Would you consider investing? Like, that rarely happens. Instead, they're like, I have some startup idea. I haven't done anything yet. Theoretically, I'd like to. Would you like to give me money to fund my dreams? And I'm like, yeah, no, sorry. I'm not in the dream business. And so that's what I would push back on young people. It's like, just, I mean, your parents' generation is the wealthiest generation we've seen in the US. And as evidenced by how much, you know, they've given us as millennials and you guys as Gen Z, they have capital to spare. And so instead of using it to go and buy just your next house, pitch your parents and their friends a deal that you're going to go after. And the beautiful part is, you're so young, you can't even really fuck it up, because you might, you'll go to them and be like, I'm going to try to do this thing. It's going to cost up a couple $100,000, and you're going to go to the richest people that you know, the people who are already probably doing deals. And you're going to say, I think it's going to work, but I'm 24. So, like, we'll see, you know, whereas when you're 40, not so good if you fuck up on a deal like that.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I mean, even right here, I've got some note that basically says, like, I tweeted this out before, like, over the next 10 to 15 years through baby boomers businesses, like, 12 million business owners are retiring. 70% have intent to sell. Like, 10 trillion plus in assets are getting transferred, right? Like, there's never been a better time, whether it's from a financing standpoint or from trying to go and get in and buy a business from a 60 to 70 year old who maybe hasn't been managing it with modern marketing practices. Like, there's never been a better time to, like, get involved and actually jump into all of that.
Yeah, totally. So I think, to your point, the only thing I'd add is, like, just learn how to structure a deal. Learn what terms are interesting for investors. Learn how to put together a pitch deck, how to put together a one pager, and copy and, you know, tweak somebody else's offering memorandum, which basically means, like, hey, Cody, will you give me money? These are the terms that you're going to give me money on. Like, learn how to do those four things, and you will be able to raise money for deals that you go after. And then pick an industry and sort of niche down in that industry, or partner with somebody that needs to raise some capital. I think the bigger thing is, like, a lot of our videos that go viral will be like, how to make money off of a vending machine, or how to make money off of ice vending. And that's cool. I get why it is. It's because they're like, oh, vending machine, I've seen it. I know what it does. It's really low risk. I could sort of figure out how to get a grand. Like, let's do this. But the same process in your mental framework that you go through to buy a vending machine or build a vending machine business, it's the same thing that you go through to do another type of business that would have a better return profile. So just, like, learn the basics, and then you kind of see the matrix, and you're like, oh shit, a deal that's $1,000 is really not that different than one that's $100,000 or $1 million. So why don't I scale up a little bit?
You mentioned partnerships, and it seems like you have an interesting perspective on, I don't know whether it's specifically maybe co-founders or how that relationship often works. I'd be curious if you could maybe kind of elaborate on why you don't think 99% of partnerships usually make sense, and maybe when they do.
Yeah, I have a funny background with partnerships. So this is totally my personal bias, but I think 99% of the time you should not have a partner, especially a 50% partner. The only way that you should have a 50% partner, in my opinion, is if you have it papered, you have it written down so incredibly well, expectations, milestones, continuation, how you guys are both going to exit at some point, what's going to happen when one person starts slowing down and doing less and you don't. I'm a bit of an animal. So I go at, like, a speed of 260 miles an hour, basically constantly. And if I have a partner, which has happened to me before, who starts slowing down or sees the money coming in and is like, well, now I want a lifestyle business, I'm pissed. You know, like, I'm not here to build lifestyle businesses. And so I think with partnerships, it's very seldom that two people want to spend their entire life executing at the same level forever. And so you need a way to push that other person out, or for you to bow out once that partnership has reached its term. I mean, 100% of partnerships end in divorce, basically, at some point. Like, it is 99.9%, whereas marriage is 50. So I prefer to always be a majority shareholder, to have other people have a percentage of it based on milestones or equity. And it's the one piece of advice I always give young people. And I see people my age and older do it too. They're like, we're going to start a podcast. It's 50-50. And I'm like, I can pretty much guarantee with like 50% certainty that with inside 2 years, one of you won't want to work on it as much as the other one, unless you guys have a blowout success. Mm-hmm. And so what are you going to do in that case? And that's how I think about partnerships. Now, what's interesting is venture capitalists love partnerships, because the main reason that businesses fail is because one of the founders gives up. And so you balance the fact that venture capitalists like to see two of you, because they know one of you is probably going to slow down, actually, with the fact that if you are the one who's not going to slow down, you don't really want that partnership to be 50-50. Mm. And that's why the greatest partner, I mean, like Steve Jobs had Wozniak, right? You even saw like Travis Kalanick had like the actual founder who was the main guy who created the company, but sort of like slowed down. Most people besides maybe Buffett and Munger have this same perspective.
That's awesome. Cody, I want to be somewhat respectful of your time. I do have one question left to kind of start wrapping things up. I know that you really pride yourself on contrarian thinking, contrarian investing, and like kind of looking at things that aren't necessarily just the norm. And I think that people who are in their 20s right now get a ton of bad advice all the time. And it leads to health problems, leads to money problems, leads to happiness problems. What is something that's maybe a little contrarian that you think that if you were in your 20s, you wish you knew, or you would tell, you know, your niece, your nephew, whatever like that, to go and kind of think about?
Yeah, I mean, our motto is civilize the mind, make savage the body, and build the bank account. So if I look at the numbers, most people die poor. Most people die overweight and healthy. Most people die not having done whatever they wanted to do for the life that they wanted to live. So if you just look at the numbers, that's kind of like a depressing stat, but it's true. Most people don't achieve any of what I consider like the three most important things in life, which is that you have like a happy and peaceful mind, and that you have a body that can continue to take care of you, and that you can continue your financial future. And so I would probably spend more time leaning on those three things, especially at 20. It's so much easier to be in shape and eat healthy when you're your age than it is when you're my age. It's so much easier to accumulate wealth if you start at your age than if you start at my age. It's so much easier to not have mental health problems and to not have issues with, you know, divorce and poor decision making later on if you start doing things like meditating, reading, and critical thinking early. So the cool part for all of you youngsters is, despite the world seeming maybe a little unfair and dark and hard, and, you know, like the generations before you made it harder on you than easier, I would say you're at this beautiful stage of life where compound living, compound investing, compound health is at the perfect stage. So just start focusing on those three things now, and you might surprise yourself in 10 years.
There was one thing that I think you tweeted out a while ago that stuck with me that I just wanted to quickly add, because we have you on the episode now, that I think would be fantastic advice for anyone in their 20s. And it was something along the lines of like, anytime something goes wrong in your life, just assume it's your fault, and you'll be so much happier, and you'll be able to start making changes to actually have the life that you want. And I think like it took me a while to like actually get to that point. But now like something goes wrong, it's like, oh, I didn't communicate that well enough. Something went wrong, it's like, oh, I didn't prepare far enough in advance for that. And I think it doesn't like, at first when I read that, I was like, oh, I think that's going to make me like a little bit depressed. Like everything's my fault. But the more I've done it, the more I've seen, oh, no, this is just an opportunity for improvement. And I didn't go communicate that like well enough. I'm going to be better in the future. So that's another thing I would maybe add for a contrarian thought for people in their 20s.
I love that. I love it. Yeah. Well, I think people give me a lot of hate for saying stuff like, it's weird, right? It's like oddly empowering. I wish I could like get everybody to make that little bit of a jump, because I think you're right. Then you realize you're not a victim to life. There's like some reason that you end up almost just about anywhere. And that means that you can change. And if it's up to the universe, then that means you are a victim. And I don't really like that idea much.
I'm completely the same way. Cody, I think this is an awesome episode. If people want to go and check you out and all the stuff that you're working on, the businesses you're building, the content you're creating, where can they go and find you?
I think probably the best is contrarianthinking.co, or I'm Cody Sanchez on Twitter, Instagram, all the things.
Awesome. We'll link to everything in the show notes. And thanks again for coming on, Cody.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes. We'll be right back.